This is Robert Stark here. My guest for today is Matt Forney. Matt, nice having you back on.
Nice to talk to you again, Robert.
So we'll be covering different news items and different topics that you've been talking about on your site. I guess the first one we'll focus on, I just got to give a warning, is this, I mean, this is some pretty disgusting material. Most of my shows, I like to keep things somewhat intellectually highbrow, but I guess this is going to be one of the more lowbrow topics, so I guess some people in our audience might need to carry a barf bag with them.
Yeah, I'd say that definitely in this case.
And I kind of coined this about you. I think one I described you once as Howard Stern of the alternative right.
That's a rather high compliment. I mean, I don't recall you saying that before, but I'll take it.
Okay, yeah. So this article, it's called Tag the Sponsor Exposes the Depravity of Modern Women, and it's about these Instagram models. And first of all, I mean, Instagram's not a site I use. I mean, the only social media site I use is Facebook, and I keep it at that. I mean, I have a Twitter account that I never use. But what basically Instagram is it's most people post pictures on there to show off their lifestyle. Like, it's a way to sort of brag about how much money and possessions that they have, or people go on there and show off their extravagant holidays. That's kind of what it is. So I think it sort of symbolizes the vanity of and narcissism of today's culture.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically Facebook, but without even the patina of using it to keep in touch with, like, friends or family or whatever. It's purely for showing off and to be and seeking attention.
So who exactly are these Instagram models? It's not really modeling. As I said, I'm not someone who follows Instagram, but they're basically... Are they like professional models, or they're just girls who go on there and they show off and say they're models?
In the particular case, the girls that I wrote about in this article of Return of Kings are more or less basically glorified prostitutes. They get most of their opulent lifestyle. They show off like Gucci purses, and they have like expensive cars and really nice clothing, but they're getting this not through actual modeling or through like work. They are sponsored by Arab oil sheiks from Saudi Arabia and whatnot. They'll fly to Dubai every so often and engage in really disgusting sex acts, and they get paid to the tune of like $20,000 to do this, or $50,000, or $40,000, some ridiculous amount of money.
I think there's a perception that high-end call girls charge maybe like at the most $5,000, so they're being paid $50,000 per sex act.
Yeah, it's worth specifying that these girls are the oil sheiks who sponsor these girls. That's where the name Tag the Sponsor comes from. They don't want to procure prostitutes. They want quote unquote fresh meat. They want girls who don't do this for a living, who are, should I say, kind of virginal, well, it, relatively speaking, compared to prostitutes. They want girls who are innocent, so that's part of the reason why they pay so much money. In fact, if they discover that they've been sent a escort, they're actually procurers, sponsors who will help organize the girls to fly over to Dubai and meet these oil sheiks and do these disgusting sex acts. If the oil sheiks find out that they've been sent a professional escort or a stripper or whatever, they'll never work with that procurer ever again. So basically, all these girls are basically, I'm not sure how to describe it. That's basically what I have to say about it.
Yeah, I mean, aren't they getting, I'm sure like ISIS is supplying them enough virgins from their escapades in Syria and Iraq.
Oh yeah, trust me, these oil sheiks are going to be marrying locals if they aren't already. They do this basically out of boredom. These are men who are insanely wealthy from the oil, from basically geographical walk. They happen to be born in an area of the world that contains a vital resource that keeps the modern world running. They're obscenely wealthy, but instead of, say, spending this money on, say, furthering science or philosophy or culture, they pay to defecate on the fly-in women from the U.S. and Western countries and defecate on their faces. I mean, that's I'm putting it graphically. That's literally what they are doing.
Yeah, I mean, these are basically people. It's like these are basically were low IQ desert tribes that had nothing, and they just lucked out and got billions of dollars. It'd basically be the equivalent of giving billions of trillions of dollars to like the citizens of South Central Los Angeles, of people who are just out, basically. And I mean, they are utterly depraved, utterly hypocrites. I mean, their own citizens are forced to live under Sharia law, and they go around financing all these jihadis and all over the place, like in Syria, and it's basically a slave state as well. Basically, Dubai is you have a minority of Emiratis who basically they sit around on their asses. They are lazy. They get just billions of dollars just from slave class, mostly from South Asia. So it's basically a slave state, and it kind of combines the worst, like the kind of I describe those societies. They combine the worst, absolute worst attributes of Arab culture with the worst attributes of American decadence.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, my article is mostly focused on criticizing the women who do this because, like, it's not like these girls are, like, desperate from hard up for cash and they're doing this out of desperation. No, they're doing it because they're greedy. They're doing it because they don't want to work for a living and they would rather get paid to do to have someone defecate on their face so they can afford a, you know, a Bentley or whatever. But on the same, on the other side of it is that these men who apparently can't find anything fair to do with their time, can't imagine anything higher than spending their obscene amounts of money on this. The entire culture of Dubai, and to a lesser extent that the Gulf region in general, revolves around this sort of pointless hedonistic opulence where you have this incredible amount of wealth, but it's all getting thrown away on these pointless frivolities, and at the same time, they basically have a slave class, as you said, basically foreign workers who have no rights and are treated like absolute dirt.
These women who become models, I mean, a lot of them are probably from, like, upper middle class suburban backgrounds. They're not, like, the stereotype of the crack hoe or the girl who gets molested by a family member and gets into the porn industry.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The other thing I have to notice about Tag the Sponsor that separates it from, like, traditional prostitution is that these girls who are being sponsored out to Dubai are, by objective standards, incredibly attractive. Like, the oil sheiks are not going to pay $20,000 to just have sex with a regular girl off the street. They want, like, supermodel quality, the best they can get. So these are girls who are from upper middle class or even upper class backgrounds who are just basically incredibly greedy and lacking in any sort of moral fabric.
Were some of the names of the specific girls involved, were their identities outed?
I don't have any on hand. However, if you go to tagthesponsor.com, which is what I was running on, they're the website that focuses on more or less exposing these girls. They have, like, a new expose on one every day, basically. And what they do is they troll them more or less by, like, pretending to be one of these sponsors and getting these girls to admit to agree to doing disgusting sex acts, and at the end they'll pull the prank, oh, we don't sponsor. So if you want to see a the names of these girls, you can go to tagthesponsor.com. They do this as a matter of fact.
And how did the information about this get leaked out?
It's actually been fairly common in it's been known as sort of underground knowledge for about a couple of years now, at least ever since Instagram became popular. But the big thing was, again, the rise of the tag, the sponsor website, because they troll models as a matter of course. It's fairly. They'll dig up like pictures off these girls' Instagram profiles and make these little snide comments, you're a hard worker, huh? But where's your W-4? The IRS would have a field day with you. Where are you getting all this money? You're just a bartender, but how can you afford a Gucci purse? You know, stuff like that. And they also troll these girls to get direct evidence that they're engaging these acts or are willing to engage in these acts for money. So that's how it became popular. I mean, that's how this became well known.
Is the thing about the getting graphic here about the defecation, is that a rumor or that's pretty widespread?
That's true. That's been well known for a few years now. Basically, because these oil sheiks are so decadent and so degenerate and so just utterly bored with their wealth that they don't want to pay for just ordinary sex. They can get that easily. They want the sort of sadistic pleasure that comes with paying a beautiful girl to defecate on her face. You know, they're paying not just for beauty, but just, you know, to do really disgusting acts.
And I mean, you probably see a lot of this type of behavior among the elites in this country, like people on Wall Street as well.
To a lesser extent, the big thing with why it's more popular with Dubai is because it's basically in a sort of quasi-legal black status. And many of these girls will, like, when they agree to be sponsored, they'll sign these contracts that will forbid them from, A, talking about it, or details leaking out. And, of course, we've discussed the quasi, you know, the way that Dubai treats foreigners and foreign workers. So there's activity going on in Wall Street, but not to the same degree. Or if it is, it's better.
Yeah, and you get a lot of times, like, you get women from countries. I think a lot of you get women from countries like the Philippines and India who go there to work as maids. And a lot of times, like, they can basically just, like, rape their maids and they'll never get charged.
Yeah, basically. Structure of immigration in the Gulf countries is designed to sort of foster this sort of thing. I mean, I forget the specific terms, but in Saudi Arabia, well, number one, in Saudi Arabia, there are no tourist visas. You can't go there as a tourist. You can only go there if you're a worker. But there's two separate worker visas. There's one that allows you to keep your passport, but you're not allowed to drive. And there's another one that allows you to drive, but you have to surrender your passport to your employer, who can keep you there as long as he wants. If he doesn't want you to leave, he can keep your passport, and then you're stuck in the country. So the entire structure of that region, not just Dubai, is around exploiting foreigners in whatever fashion they can.
Is this what you're talking about? Is it more common in Dubai or Saudi Arabia, or about
Dubai is basically the hedonism. It's the Las Vegas of the Middle East. It's where all the sheiks go to cut loose. But the same sort of general attitude of exploiting foreigners and having no regard for foreigners and using them while simultaneously preaching against the moral degeneracy and un-Islamic values is completely prevalent throughout the entire region.
Yeah, because a lot of people in the Arab world and the Muslim people despise the sheikhs there for their hypocrisy. But I mean, the irony is that people in the Arab world will talk about the decadence of America, and or they'll talk about the decadence of say Jews in Hollywood. But I mean, the Arab elites in those countries take decadence to a whole new level that would put that basically put the American elites to shame, even.
I mean, yeah. I mean, if there's one like semi-positive thing I can say about tag the sponsor, it makes me feel a hell of a lot better about my own country. To pardon my language, because that sort of thing is not going on. As degenerate as America has become, we're not engaging in that. Our elites aren't, or at least to our knowledge, are not engaging in that behavior to the level that the Arab sheiks are.
But you could say that America is responsible. I mean, America is responsible for propping up those Arab sheikhs. So America is responsible directly responsible.
Oh, absolutely true in that regard. It's just, you know, I forget the specific term in Catholic theology. Oh, there's the sin of commission and there's the sin of omission or something like that. There's a difference between, you know, propping them up versus them actually doing it, you know. I'm not excusing America in that regard. It's just, you know.
And in your article, you focus more on, you don't really get into the culture in Dubai as much in your article. You focus more on, well, you say tag the sponsor symbolizes the depravity of modern women. So your strongest criticism in the article on basically American culture is what you're getting at.
Yes, because like I came at this from the perspective of, well, I lived in the Philippines for part of last year, and I was witness to the sex industry in Manila. The general, belief of prostitutes in, like, the Philippines, Thailand, and the third world is that they do it because they're desperate and they need money. Now, there probably are some cases like that, but the vast majority of the ones I encountered, you know, it's almost impossible to avoid the sex industry if you live in Manila, even regardless of who you are. We're doing it because they were more or less greedy. They, in relative to other workers in the Philippines, the prostitutes, the freelancers, as they call themselves, make much more money. In the same thing is going on with these girls who are being sponsored on Instagram. They're doing it because there's no moral code inside them that tells them basically go flying to the other side of the world to get defecated on by these sheiks is wrong. It's not something you should be doing. And doing these sorts of things does leave long-term psychological damage, even absent the moral aspect of it.
So there was another article on Return of the Kings. You do not write this article, but it's about do these women become irreparably damaged?
Yeah. I didn't write it. It was written by Donovan Sharp, a colleague of mine. But my personal argument is that the chances are very high that it will cause damage because, again, this goes back to my experiences in the Philippine sex industry. In my article, I wrote about how I went to a club in the Malate district of Manila one night, and there was this, while I was hanging out, this fat hooker tried to pull me aside, dance with me on the dance floor, and then tried to offer me quote-unquote boom boom for 1,000 pesos. Now, this chick was in her late 30s, but she looked like she was 10 years older. She was fat, and to put it bluntly, I wouldn't have let her pay me to sleep with her. I mean, at the same time, I felt a little sorry for her because, you know, having to do that for a living at that point is gonna, it has to be a depressing existence. And in the case of these girls, you know, the memory of being the money they get from these from being sponsored won't last very long. The Gucci purchase will wear out. The Bentley will have to get replaced. But the memory of having done these things will stick them for a long while. And I hate to say it. I don't take any great pleasure in saying this. A lot of these Instagram models may end up committing suicide or ending up. It's like the Playboy bunny curse, where a lot of women who posed for Playboy, even going back to the 60s, ended up dying tragically in car crashes because they live dissolute lifestyles. It's the same thing with these Instagram models. Many of them are going to end up having bad ends in part because of the choices they've made here.
There's something like that. Are you familiar with Luke Ford?
I've heard the name. I'm not too familiar with him, though.
I mean, he did. I've interviewed him many times. He was a journalist in the porn industry, and he said something. This is about porn, but I mean, he was saying that like once a woman is videotaped on film, covered in cum, no one will ever take her seriously as a human being.
I'd say that that's a big part of it. Obviously there are exceptions. I mean, there are women who can go through this sort of thing and then turn their lives around, like. I I wrote about in Return of Kings recently about the retired porn star Cytheria, who was raped after she's retired. She's got married. She has a husband and kids. But like the vast majority of women who are going into this who are doing this sort of sponsor thing or getting involved in the sex industry have no clue what they're getting into. And when it comes to like say the Duke porn star Bell Knox, the media is being incredibly irresponsible in trying to promote this and normalize it for young girls because it's going to hurt them in the long run.
And was this kind of stuff Bell Knox was in, was it to this level of depravity?
It wasn't to this level of depravity, but you can say, I mean, you can see, like, if you, the people who sort of praised her probably didn't really watch some of the videos she's been in, like facial abuse. You can clearly see that she is disgusted with herself. She almost looks like she's about to start crying. And she admitted in an interview, I forget who it was, a few months ago. This is after the initial publicity she got, that she was not happy with the industry and it was making her cynical and bitter inside, you know.
And this other article, this is your most recent article, ties back to this topic. So you talk about this former, is it a Playboy model who committed suicide and her husband?
Yes, Cassandra Lynn or Cassandra Hensley. She married in her late 20s. She met this guy Gary Hensley. She already had two kids from a previous fling she had with a guy. The guy was a deadbeat, was not paying anything in child support. This guy, Gary Hensley, married her and was helping raise her kids. Then one day she took off and was found several weeks later having A, cheated on him with another guy, and B, she overdosed on cocaine and alcohol and died in a bathtub. That the same sort of mentality. You go into the sex industry, or maybe the women who are attracted to it are already damaged, but at the same time, it's not something you want to promote.
And in your article, you also talk about the man who married her. Is there a lot of information about him specifically, or you're just talking about a sort of a general scenario? And this goes back to the question of the women you talked about and tagged the sponsor. I mean, at some point, do you think a lot of them could very well get married at some point, even though they're permanently psychologically scarred?
I think a lot of them could get married, but the reality is that a lot of them could possibly end up like Cassandra Lynn, because in the case of Gary Hensley, I talked about it in a general fashion, but at the same time, the article that I linked to, that was the feature piece about Cassandra Lynn's death, also focused a lot on him. It was from the Washington Post. He was sort of an ordinary guy, a startup guy, probably, to use a manosphere terminology, kind of a beta male. Probably wasn't that successful with women. So when this, like, fairly attractive former playmate and model started coming on to him, he probably couldn't resist. And at the same, and by marrying her and trying to sort of turn her around and make her into a housewife, well, he did something incredibly stupid. Because I mean, the tragedy of it is, like, some of these women can turn their lives around, but you can't, like, you can't force someone to change their life around. It's sort of like that quote from that Morpheus says to Neo in The Matrix. You know, you can show someone the door, but they have to walk through it. And in the case of women like Cassandra Lynn, they don't want to change. They're broken. They're messed up. They're drug addicts, and there's very little that anyone can do about it.
Well, basically what you say is we talk about men in general, and so the man who married her was, economically, he was fairly well off, but you said that a lot of men have no clue in how to attract women in their 20s, so they basically take what little they can get, and then when they enter their 30s, a lot of them become established in their careers. Well, and then you go on to say that their same-aged peers, their looks start to fade. But the thing is, even though they become successful and they improve themselves, they still have this attitude of desperation.
Yeah, I mean, old habits die hard, and these guys carry into their 30s as they're, to use the manosphere terminology again, I try not to use it too much, but it's a proper descriptor, actual market value increases, but they still have the attitude that they had when they were, you know, younger and loveless. There wasn't, And and this makes them vulnerable to the predations of women like Cassandra Lynn, who are at that point on the downward bell curve of their attractiveness and are trying to settle down and are trying to, you know, after partying and doing whatever when they were young, they finally decided to have a family.
You're not going to use the cheesy manosphere term, the cock carousel. You're going to put a moratorium on those terms.
I wasn't sure if I could get that risque on the show, but yeah, that's
okay.
That's basically what I'm saying. But yeah, well, I was avoiding cock carousel because I didn't want to sound too crass, but yeah, basically that's the sentiment I'm trying to get across.
And back to the topic, a lot of those guys they're desperate or they have trouble not being able to determine the past of that woman.
I think it's a combination of both. Like, number one, they're just so happy that a woman is finally paying attention to them, an attractive woman at that, in the specific case of Gary Hensley. And two, they either don't notice the past, or they try to think, well, it's all in the past, you know, she's different now, she's grown up, which, as it turns out, in most cases, is not anywhere even close to the to reality.
Yeah, kind of like that movie, what's it called, Chasing Amy.
Ah, oh, God, that's a perfect example.
Do you see that kind of, do you see that happening with a lot of Western men who go to the Philippines? Do you notice that a lot?
Oh, definitely. Well, it's more common in Thailand from what I've heard. There's a lot of cases of men who will go to Thailand. They'll fall in love with a prostitute, and she'll basically bilk them for everything. Like, oh, they're going to set up for a marriage, and he'll give her money, and then she'll just abscond with it. It's a bit less common in the Philippines because there's a stronger Catholic influence there. But the thing that I noticed in the Philippines is a lot of guys are so astounded as to women paying attention to them and checking them out, because white men, Western men, are very high value there. They'll just marry the first girl who is nice to them, which can end disastrously. It can work out well. It's just... It's less dangerous in the Philippines, but it's more of a case of, you know, these guys are just so inured to being ignored that they'll just settle for whatever, the first girl that comes along, which is something you don't want to do.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure a lot of them could do a lot better, but they pick the first thing that comes along.
Yeah, I mean, particularly in the case of the Philippines, I mean, pretty much all the girls are expected to be feminine, nice, and housewifely or something like that. So marrying one just because she's nice and feminine and skinny is, well, it's they're standard features over there. It's like, that's like marrying a Filipino because she's nice and feminine is like buying a car because it has a steering wheel. The cars are supposed to have steering wheels. In the specific case of the Philippines and in women in general, you have to be a bit more, you have to specify a bit more and be a bit more selective.
So you could actually say that in the West, if someone is sweet and feminine, that would you say it's more genuine, or no?
I'd say it's a bit more genuine, but at the same time, I'd still, you know, never rush into anything, you know. I mean, it's not that the women in the Philippines are less genuine. It's just, you know, it's more common there because it's part of the culture, so.
So before we move on to a different topic, is there anything else you could add about Tag the Sponsor? I mean, this is a pretty extensive article. Is there anything else about that story that we didn't touch upon?
Not really. I'd suggest that if you want to learn more, well, you can read my article on Return to Kings, but you should also check out the website itself, Tag the Sponsor. Though you may want to, you know, avoid eating or not check it if you've eaten, because some of the material on there is pretty gross.
I mean, were you personally shocked by that story?
I didn't think I'd be shocked by anything anymore, but that shocked not only me, but it shocked a lot of people. My inspiration for writing the article was from a friend on the Roosh V forum, which at last count was something like 30 pages long, full of guys who were like just... guys who have been reading stuff like this for years and they've been experienced with women, even they were completely floored by what Tag the Sponsor was about.
And as you said, you wouldn't see this happening, 30 years ago.
No. It's a really an example of just how far we've slid into Gomorrah since then, to quote Robert Bork.
So basically, would you say we're one of the most depraved societies in history, or would you say that Dubai is even more depraved than we are?
I don't know if I'd quantify it, but that's basically, I'd just say, yeah, we are probably up there. I wouldn't say one, but that's just how it is.
And, I mean, you're relatively young. I mean, you're even a little bit younger than me. Have you noticed a change in depravity in your lifetime?
Well, I've noticed that stuff, well, I'll try not to get too crass. Like the cliche was back in like the 90s that it was like Bill Clinton and the Lewinsky scandal that popularized oral sex. Well, I noticed that in like the 10 years that I've been paying attention to this stuff like anal sex used to be more or less a sort of porn thing. Now it's pretty much standard among women my age.
It used to be considered a gay thing.
Yeah, that. And now it's pretty much acceptable. It's pretty much accepted for heterosexuals. You see sites like Gawker promoting analingus, stuff like that.
But you're basically saying stuff like that is promoted is basically on mainstream news items as just regular behavior.
Yeah.
And in the past, it's
regular,
something like analingus,
yeah,
would be seen as very, very perverse.
If you talked about analingus 30 years ago, people would look at you like you were some kind of like space alien. Now it's just accepted standard behavior. As you said, it's cool, it's hip. And if you aren't doing it, you're some kind of, you know, freak.
So onto a entirely different topic. You wrote this article, and you got a lot of responses from this on alternative. This is your last article. I don't know if it was your last article on alternative right, but you had an article called "Face to Face with Race" by Jared. You reviewed a book by Jared Taylor.
Yes. Well, to specify, it wasn't really by him. It was a compilation of articles that were published by American Renaissance, of which Jared Taylor is the head. He wrote the introduction and he compiled it. But yes, it's his book. I wrote. Andy Nowicki asked me to review the book when it was released, and I did. So.
And what are some of the things that I've read one of his books, but I have not read this book in particular. And these are types of issues you don't. It's definitely a major focus on the alternative right, but on you tend not to focus on these type of issues as much.
Yeah. In general, the book "Face to Face with Race" is a compilation of basically whites' experiences with minorities, specifically blacks. The book, I joked in the review, the book would more likely be called "Face to Face with Blacks" because that's basically what it's about. Latinos and Asians are sort of glossed over. It's basically like, for example, one of the stories is about a white MTA conductor who ran subways in New York City in the blackest parts of the Bronx, and he would talk about how black passengers would throw things at his head while he was driving down the subway, or they'd spit in his face, or try and injure him while he's driving the train, stuff like that. And the book doesn't really enforce a point of view, but the basic implication is that living with blacks is really unpleasant, or the sort of pathologies that black people exhibit nowadays.
And have you experienced that firsthand?
I've had my own run-ins with black people in that regard, but nothing to the degree in that book. I've been semi-fortunate. I mean, my biggest experience with blacks was when I went to a public school when I was in elementary school. I grew up in Syracuse, New York, which is where these schools are, if I recall correctly, majority black now. And basically, if you're a white person dealing with going to a public school in Syracuse, you're going to be dealing with, you're basically going to be harassed by blacks day in, day out, to the degree where you get, you know, you got schools like high schools that have metal detectors because people are bringing guns in. So I haven't experienced anything to the, I have my own issues with blacks, but I haven't experienced anything to the degree of the stories that were talked about in Jared Taylor's book.
And you don't experience that kind of behavior. You haven't experienced it in the Philippines at all.
Oh, no, not. I sort of contrasted the behavior of Filipinos with the behavior of American blacks. Now, the Philippines is a very poor country, but the average, even the poorest Filipinos have a certain dignity and a certain class that infinitely wealthier blacks, even poor blacks in this country, don't have. Like, I spent 2 months in Davao City, which is has a lot of poverty, but even still, I could walk through that city at night without having to worry about getting robbed, without having to worry about getting mugged or even harassed. In fact, like, people would see that I was a foreigner, and they'd, like, help me out. I was like, do you need help? What are you looking for? Are you looking for someone? I was like, no, I'm fine, but thanks anyway. Whereas blacks, who are, in a historical sense, they're not only one of the wealthiest groups in the world, they're wealthier in many ways than historically, like, blacks and their ancestors in Africa have been, yet they exhibit all these, like, hostility towards white people, hostility towards learning, hostility towards authority, just antisocial behavior that completely does not make any sense at all.
You have this other article you wrote about, this was from a while back, but about New York City and the triumph of the new mayor, de Blasio.
Yes, basically. One of the big things I've noticed with Bill de Blasio was elected in 2013, and in the year since, I've watched basically the decline of the city under his aegis, most notably, which most people who've read the news know about, the conflict between him and the New York City Police Department, the killing of two police officers in Brooklyn, completely random shooting because the blacks there were all, you know, screw the police, and de Blasio was trying to play both the ghetto blacks, which formed one of his major constituencies, and the police department against each other, to which the NYPD was just like, you know, we're not going to do this anymore. They were starting to reduce their they were issuing fewer traffic tickets, and they also told the mayor not to show up at any police officers' funerals from now on.
With the whole debate with the police, I mean, there's sort of two sides of it. I mean, yes, I mean, America is becoming a police state, and there are plenty of cops that are assholes. But on the other hand, a lot of the left makes it purely about race and white racism. And there is a culture definitely among the black underclass to go out of their way to basically behave badly. So there's two sides of it.
I mean,
one side, I'm not one of those people who worships the cops and says the cops are all saints, but at the same time, I'm also critical. I mean, the way that the left reacts to it is flawed, too. So, yeah, I think it's important to look at this issue with nuance.
Yeah, basically. I mean, the police have overreached in many particular areas of America. I mean, I'll give you an example. A couple of years ago, in my hometown of Syracuse, there was an incident where the police grabbed a retarded man off of a physically and mentally retarded man off of a bus and beat him so severely that A, they broke his hip, and two, when they took him to his crime was that he wouldn't sit down on a bus. He wouldn't sit down on the bus. He preferred to stand up, and the driver called the police. Not only that, when they were booking him for whatever it was, trespassing or whatever, the cops who beat him up didn't tell the cops at the station that his hip was broken, so they made this retarded guy stand up with a broken hip and walk through a metal detector, even though he could barely walk. That is real. That stuff is real. That stuff happens every day, and we have to push back against that kind of abuse. Yet at the same time, not every single cop is an asshole. Not every single police department is corrupt. The NYPD, as far as police departments in this country goes, is actually pretty honest. They're pretty. They will rarely ever bother you unless you look like an obvious criminal or you're doing something blatantly illegal. And even then, if you're polite, you can get out of it pretty easily. I mean, and the left is trying to engender hatred between minority communities, particularly blacks, and the police, which is erupting into outright violence, as we're seeing in both New York City and Ferguson now.
Yeah, and I think it's would you say that in regards to issues, the behavior of the police, do you think it's worse in some parts of the country where the basically how police treat the citizens? Well, in some areas where there's suburban areas that there's very low crime and the police there are bored, so they're always looking for stuff to do, so there are cases of them just going around and harassing people.
Oh yeah, basically. But I'd say it varies by region too. Like police, in my observation, out west in western states tend to be a bit more lax. The only exception I'm going to think of is like Spokane, Washington, which probably has the worst, most corrupt police department of like major cities in America, to the point where there are whole blogs just dedicated to cataloging the corruption and the assholery that the Spokane police are getting down to. But there's a difference between calling out corruption in the police department and pushing against the laws that and overreach by the police, and say just engendering hatred against police in general. Like for example, the Eric Garner case in New York City. Eric Garner was killed because he was selling Lucy's cigarettes in violation of laws that the left put in place in New York City. Because the taxes on cigarettes in New York City are so high, it was profitable for Eric Garner to sell Lucy's to homeless people. And he was killed because of a law the left themselves put into place, and now they're crying crocodile tears over the fact that he was killed over it. But pretty much in all cases, not all cases, but a lot of the cases, a lot of the police overreach is due to policies that the left themselves has either implemented or they benefit from in some fashion. Like, for example, the overreaches of the New York City Police Department primarily benefited one group, the sort of white left-wing hipsters who've streamed in from Wisconsin, Minnesota, the Midwest, the sorts of, you know, pansies who wouldn't have dared gone to New York City when it was the crime-ridden hellhole it was in the 70s and 80s when the NYPD started cracking down on, squeegee men and whatnot. That's when they all of a sudden they decided it was safe enough to settle into, and now they're complaining about the police policies that made it safe, the city safe for them to live in to begin with.
And this article you had about, it's called A Triumph Hope Experience about de Blasio. You talk about a lot about how New York was very dangerous in the 70s and 80s, and it changed during the Giuliani era, and how a lot of native New Yorkers complain how New York has lost a lot of its character. I think you talk about this commentary by the Talking Heads. Is that the one?
Yeah, by Talking Heads frontman David Byrne. He was complaining about how the city has sort of become, it's gentrified and it's more or less lost its soul, which is a demonstrable fact. During the gentrification under Giuliani and Bloomberg, many native New Yorkers were priced out to the suburbs. In their place, we have these hipsters on mommy's trust funds from Milwaukee or Minnesota or whatever, who are driving up the prices and who are instituting all these ridiculous left-wing policies. I mean, they're the primary reason why Bill de Blasio became mayor. He would not have been able to get anywhere were it not for the votes of, I mean, he panders to minorities as well, but it was what the support of the white hipsters who put him over the top.
Are you old enough to remember how New York used to be?
Well, I'm turning 27 in June. I'm not that old, but my mom used to talk about it. Like she was old enough to remember. Her family came out of Brooklyn, and she was old enough to remember that. Like for example, in the 70s, Central Park, which was probably one of the most famous, you know, parts of New York City, was an open air drug bazaar at night. Like if you entered Central Park at night, there was a very good chance you could get shot. And the only reason you would go there at night would be like to buy drugs or sell drugs. But nowadays, you can go down to New York City, Central Park. It's so safe at night that you got young women walking their dogs there alone. So, and you can just look at crime rates, information from the FBI to see how dangerous the city was in the 70s and 80s. The wave of arsons that occurred in 1977, the big blackout that almost plunged the city in utter chaos, the city going bankrupt when Gerald Ford was president, the infamous Gerald Ford to New York drop dead line for the Daily News, and you can see how nice the city is now, and you can see the difference, and you can see how the idiocy of de Blasio on the left is just going to completely ruin that.
When when Giuliani was mayor, did he shut down most of the sex industry in New York?
Pretty much. Some of it was actually shut down under Ed Koch, but Giuliani was instrumental in driving a lot of the petty street crime underground or driving it out of the city entirely. The big thing he did was cracking down. Well, the big thing he did, and William Bratton, the chief of police, was cracking down on petty crimes such as turnstile jumping and like the squeegee men, which under the broken windows theory helped shut down greater crimes such as arson and whatnot. And under his aegis, the level of street crime, murders and rapes and muggings went way down.
Oh, and then the other thing in your article, you talk about the cultural icons that New York City has produced. You contrast, say, someone today like Lena Dunham to Andy Warhol and Talking Heads. You talk about the cultural change.
My point is, I looked at it from both sides. On the one hand, New York City is safe today. On the other hand, it's so safe that this is what David Byrne was talking about, the city has lost its soul. The artistic efforts that are coming out of the city's major figures now are completely limp. I mean, the 70s and 80s was a bad time to be in Manhattan, but it was also a great time for music and arts. That was when it was that era of the city's history that produced the no-wave movement, punk bands like Sonic Youth, television, Talking Heads came out of that era, the Andy Warhol and the factory scene, the Velvet Underground, Lou Reed. So there's a sort of balancing act. A city, a culture that is overly comfortable becomes decadent and becomes too obsessed with its own brilliance, which I sort of ties back into Tag the Sponsor you were talking about earlier. The opulence in the Middle East and the opulence in the Dubai and the oil sheiks has led them to become completely decadent. And in many ways, you see the same thing in modern New York City, where the city is so safe and so sterilized now that there's no cultural growth at all.
And would you say this is basically a trend of a lot of? Would you say it's basically a trend of a lot of the major cities of the world? I don't know how well traveled you are, but the major cities of, say, Europe or North America.
I'd say it's a major trend in the cities that have been following similar paths. I really can't speak to Europe because I haven't been there, but I would say that a lot of the major, culture itself is sort of becoming ossified in the U.S. because, well, as a general fact, murders and rapes and violent crimes have been going down. Now, I'm not saying that we should have high murder rates. We should strive to have a safe community, but at the same time, a culture that is overly insulated and a culture that's overly cocooned is not going to produce anything of great value. I mean, in 10 years, people are going to be looking at, say, the artistic corpus of Lena Dunham and thinking to themselves, how the hell did anyone ever like her? stuff like that.
Are there any major modern-day cultural icons in the arts, music, visual arts, theater, writing, television, that you would say are noteworthy of value?
Honest to God, I mean, I used to be a big, I'm a musician, and I used to be big into, like, indie music, but honest to God, I've lost interest in it because a lot of it is just, it's, there really hasn't been any sort of great big cultural shifts in the past 20 years. I mean, I wasn't the first person to make this observation. I forgot who it was. It was one of my friends, I think. But basically, there haven't really been any new, for example, there haven't really been any new musical genres invented in the past 20, 30 years. Well, 20 years at least. In the year 2015, we're still listening to the same sort of variants on the same sort of genres that were conceived of during, from the 60s up to the 80s. We're still listening to rap. We're still listening to pop music. We're still listening. Indie music really hasn't really, indie rock hasn't really advanced. Nothing has advanced. We're coming up with variations on the same themes, but nothing, there's no, we haven't experienced a great cultural shift in the same way that rock and roll changed popular culture, or say, disco came about in the 70s, or you had new wave in the 80s. Our culture is very stagnant, and I think that has part of it has to do with the way the you get the cocooning and the gentrification and the insulation in places like New York City and other cultural capitals from real human concern.
And people are more young people today are more likely to spend a lot of their time watching TV or on social media than having actual experiences.
Yeah, I mean they don't go out and have fun anymore. I mean, well, part of it is because their parents won't let them. You know, got helicopter parents. You know, don't talk to strangers. They might abduct you. You know, don't play outside. You might break a. You might scuff your knee. They just sit inside and play video games and screw around on Facebook and don't do anything adventurous. So the end result is that we have a generation now that is, to put it bluntly, socially retarded. Their horizons are so narrow. Their intellect so limited, their social skills so atrophied that they can't even, like, you got like cases like man spreading, the complaint of man spreading on the subways, because apparently women find it too stressful to just ask someone on the subway if they could sit down next to them, stuff like that. And the culture and the music and the art they're, and the writing they're producing is just utterly reflective of their navel gazing, insular, masturbatory mentalities.
So, Matt, it's been a great show.
It's been great talking to you again, Robert. It's been a while since we've done this. Yeah.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.
Thanks for having me on again.